Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 13th of March 2016. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Johnny Fox, Laura Cressley, Paul in London, Phil from the West End Whingers, and Web Calco. We're now going to talk about Welcome Home, Captain Fox, which is a new version of Jean-Henri's Le Voyageur sans Bagage, written by Anthony Way and directed by Blanche McIntyre. Anthony Way has transposed the original post-First World War setting to 1959 in Long Island, or in the Hamptons, and it's a long hot summer, and this man's come back from East Germany, where he was held prisoner, possibly first by the Germans and then by the Russians after the war, and he's come back having lost his memory, and we're not entirely sure that he is this Jack Fox, Captain Jack Fox, that he is believed to be. It is a bit of an oddity, this, because 15 years doesn't feel like long enough to completely forget what somebody looks like, and that bothered me throughout the play. But this production stars Rory Keenan as Jack Fox. We have Catherine Kingsley and Danny Webb as the couple who discover him in a nursing home where he's been brought over from Germany and reckon that he's the best prospect to be the missing Captain Jack Fox. The idea is that they go for the richest missing person first, and then they will go to the next richest and the next richest, and in the hope that they will get some kind of reward money for what they're doing. Catherine Kingsley is dressed very much like Lucille Ball, so she does quite a lot of explaining in the plot. We have Barnaby Kay as his brother, Fenella Woolgar as sister-in-law, Sean Thomas as his mother, Michelle Asante and Trevor Laird as the house retainers, who seem to always, as ever with servants, seem to know a lot more than they're letting on. And then we get Daniel York, who comes in later with one of Kit Connor, Ilan Galkoff, or Rory Stroud as a child, because there are other possibilities about who Captain Jack Fox might be, or this character who's turned up might actually be, and they're all trying to claim him for himself, and he's not entirely sure if he wants to be claimed. Gareth, could you tell me more about this play and what you thought about it?
Well, about the playwright, first of all, I think Jean-Henri is probably one of the world's most prolific playwrights. He apparently wrote something like 60 plays over his 40-year playwriting career, so he exceeded Shakespeare and just about matches Anna Leghorn, I think. But we actually don't see much of his work here. I mean, the one we see most, I think, is his adaptation of Sophocles' Antigone. But I'm struggling to recall, and I look through the list of plays he'd written, although they're mostly French titles, so I might have seen things in adaptations with English titles that were by him. But I don't recall seeing very much of his work, and this was his first big hit. I think it was his third play, and his first big hit, and as you say, in French it was called Le Voyageur sans Bagage. And relocated from the 30s France, in which it was written, by Anthony Waite, to late 50s Long Island, with the sort of American upper middle class. I think if you just think Philadelphia Story, you just about get the setting, really. But what they've added in, which I really, really liked, although it's linked to a particular character's liking of them, they've added in French songs between scenes, which I thought was a really rather nice nod to the origin of the play. As you say, I mean, a soldier comes back to the US after 14 years after the Second World War with amnesia. He's in the sanatorium. And the Dupont-Dufours, this couple from Miami, who now, you know, he's a businessman who's made it, and he's got a kind of trophy wife. And they've come up from Miami. They're now in the New York area. And she has projects, and she's moved on from rescuing dogs to finding the family of this man in the sanatorium with amnesia. A project that her husband, DeWitt Dupont Dufour, isn't as keen on as she is herself. And she engages a gossip columnist to select the most likely from the 22 possibles on the list she has. And that's how they end up visiting this family. And indeed, the family take him in, and he learns about his past. And what then happens is that the gossip columnist names this family, and the other 21 all kind of turn up, which provides chaos, but the chaos is offstage. I just love this evening, and I walked out of the theatre mumbling, "That's proper entertainment," to myself, because I've had a run of depressing things and dull things, and it was just so uplifting to just see something that was just, you know, light but very, very well done, because the production just sparkles in absolutely every sense, really, you know, from the adaptation, which I think is outstanding, to Mark Thompson's design, which is actually very bright, and indeed Blanche McIntyre, who's talked about a lot but whose work I've seen little of, but what I have seen I've admired very much, her impeccable staging. But I think above all, it's the casting that carries this play. And even though, you know, you've mentioned the sort of lead characters, for me, Catherine Kingsley is just a joy to behold as Marcy de Pontefort, who's this trophy wife. And she's got a sort of touch of Mrs. Malaprop about her, but she is just fabulous. She looks fabulous. She's just great comic timing, brilliant. You know, she really gets every laugh out of the line she's got. And I also really, really like Danny Webb, who actually, had I not had a program, may not have realized it was Danny Webb, because he's very unrecognizable. He's very stooped. He's mustachioed. He's got a cigar in his mouth. He's channeling Groucho Marx. And he's just fantastic as her straight-talking husband. So those two, for me, they stole the show, really. Having said that, Sian Thomas is a real treat as the sort of snobby mother, and Fenella Wilgar, I thought, was delightful as her rather brittle daughter-in-law. And, I mean, all of them were just great. It was just the casting that made this show for me, really. So it's just a fun night in the theatre, and I just kind of was walking out thinking, how many fun nights in the theatre do you get these days? And I also wondered, you know, how many other gems are hidden in that sort of 60-play back catalogue, really? So, you know, as I said, as I walked out, I stand by now, it's just proper entertainment, and I absolutely loved it. John, what did you think?
I'm really the same, except rather than thinking that Danny Webb was channeling Groucho Marx, I thought that he and Catherine Kingsley were George Burns and Gracie Allen. I thought it was that kind of playoff between them, that he was very dry and sardonic and only delivered his lines chomped through the end of his cigar, you know, right after she wrung every nuance out of every joke beforehand. But what a great comic pairing, and just what a great cast. And like you, I really did come out of this feeling quite uplifted, especially as I saw it right on the back of having seen Cleansed. So, you know, from the depths of despair and misery coming out of the National Theatre thinking, well, that was a waste of 35 quid, to going to something like this, I thought it was a breeze. I mean, it really was a piece of genius by Anthony Way to jumpstart this and move it forward 22 years or something like that to the late 1950s. You know, London has a taste for this kind of American vacationing 50s style. You know, we just loved Grey Gardens, and Casa Valentina is set in the same sort of location and time. And it just makes you want to holiday in the Hamptons in the late 1950s. I thought that what Anthony Way had done with this, really, to the original Jean Anouilh play, and I should say that, you know, I went to university to read French, and I did have to do a lot of Anouilh, at least in my first year, before I gave it all up. And I don't remember Le Voyageur sans Bagage being remotely funny. I think it's more a family drama than it is a comedy. And to jack it up into this kind of slightly farcical, but really, really very wordy and witty comedy as well, is intensely good work. And it reminded me of what Richard Bean had done to the old Carlo Goldoni Servant of Two Masters to turn it into One Man, Two Governors. I think it's the same kind of revision. And the only thing that surprises me is that obviously Goldoni, having been writing in the 1740s, is well out of copyright. But, you know, Anouilh's only been dead about 30 years, so his work must be licensed in a different way. And I am surprised they were allowed to manipulate it as much as they have done. Although perhaps, as Gareth says, you know, because it's not a very frequently performed play, it's certainly not up there with Beckett or Antigone, there may be more reason that the Anouilh estate would allow this to be reprocessed in such an interesting and successful way. I would love now to see it sent back to France and see what they made of this production. But it's just breathtakingly good. It's bright. It's got that texture of, you know, like a Doris Day comedy with the costumes and the overlighting. It is a brilliant thing. And so often when you go to the Dunmore, things are quite shadowy. It's very unusual. You know, I didn't know they could turn the lights up that bright, and how nice that they have done. Again, agree with Gareth. What a cracking cast. You know, Sian Thomas and Fenella Wilgar are people who can do no wrong for me, but I thought Fenella Woolgar in particular, it's not a very large part that she has as the daughter-in-law of this family that may or may not accept Captain Fox as their son and heir. But the way she really, really works the lines and her expressions are just superb. She is really very, very good. I'd also say a nice word for Barnaby Kay. He's the existing son of the family who obviously stands to be elbowed aside if they take on a new son and heir. And that could be quite a cardboard set of reactions. And he doesn't. He really weighs it much more carefully than that. And I thought his work was very nuanced and very watchable. But obviously, as this character, Gene, or as the family want to call him, Jack, Rory Kinnan is excellent. He really is. And both his sort of physical clowning and his double takes and the way he serves up his lines is really glorious. I liked it very, very much indeed. I had thought when I went to see it, because I knew just a little bit about the background of it, I thought it was going to be a bit like Martin Guerre. But of course, it's Martin Guerre stood on its head, because in Martin Guerre, he is trying to prove he is who he says he is. Whereas in this case, somebody completely other is trying to prove he is who he doesn't even think he is. And I liked the ambivalence that the play doesn't quite come to a conclusion. And that does follow the original plot. In the original plot, he does accept the narrative of one of the other claimant families because it is a little bit more convenient for him than being embraced by what may be his real-life actual family. But they are so nightmarish that he can't countenance it. But yes, just a good piece of work because it takes an interesting piece of writing by a very successful and globally recognised playwright and makes it into something else. But also, even if this just been written 6 months ago, it would be a really, really excellent comedy, and I absolutely loved it. I have seen detractors, particularly younger writers, younger critics, have found it a little bit too pat and too easy for them. It doesn't have great sort of psychological depths, but I just thought it was really amusing, and I had a great time.
We're now going to talk about Correspondence at the Old Red Lion Theatre. This is a play by Lucinda Burnett, directed by Blythe Stewart. Laura, could you tell me more about this and what you thought of it?
It's a play that touches on several different themes. It starts with the conflict in Syria using two teenage boys as a framing device. Then it moves on to confront mental health and psychotic episodes. Then goes on to tie up all of these issues in a final section of the play and has a bit of a resolution. Now, I quite enjoyed the play in some ways. In others, I thought it needed quite a bit of work. The first section with the two lads, one's in Syria, the character's called Jibril, and the second one is a boy in Stockport. He's 16 years old. He's doing his exams, or about to do his exams. He's called Ben. Ben and Jibril meet regularly on Xbox Live, which is taking the Xbox platform and putting it on the internet so people all over the world can interact and play games together and chat whilst they're playing games and these sorts of things. The two of them sort of become friends as much as you can be over such a platform. And Jibril is in Syria. This is all set in 2011, so before the Syrian conflict all kicks off. And there's some really lovely scenes, lovely moments between the two boys talking about all sorts of things that teenage boys talk about, banter and school. And Ben's quite an inquisitive young man. He asks Jibril quite a lot of questions about what it's like growing up in Syria, what people do, any differences between there and England, that sort of thing. And Jibril is sometimes, well, he gradually becomes a bit more cagey with his information because the Syrian conflict is all starting to kick off. The rebels are starting to rebel against the government and people are starting to disappear. But at this point, it's not really making the news so much over in England. And Ben decides that he's going to join these rebels and go into some big protest over in Syria. And he does this on the sly without telling his lovely but somewhat dysfunctional divorced parents. And what triggers this is at one point, Jibril stops appearing for their Xbox Live sessions. He logs on at the same time, but Jibril never turns up. So Ben becomes really concerned that Jibril has disappeared, because Jibril had talked about how other teenagers have been made to disappear by the regime, particularly a group of graffiti artists who wrote some political graffiti on a school and then were never seen again. So Ben decides he's going to take matters into his own hands and go and fight the government with all of the Syrian people. That's the first section of the play. I'd say probably the first third to a half is this dialogue between the two boys. And you see Ben's parents as well, and another character called Harriet, who's the local school bully. She's quite an interesting one, and I think other people will talk about her a bit more later. But Ben's a bit of a loner, though quite an intelligent young man, and he decides to go over to Syria. But that's where, to me, I think the play starts to fall apart a bit. Up to that point, so much of the play was about the relationship between these two young boys and a bit about what's going on in Syria, but that was really the centre of the plot. After that, it sort of lost its way a bit. The writing was quite nice. The dialogue was really lovely. Some of the best moments in the play were between Ben and Jibril. But after Ben goes to Syria, it all sorts to fall apart a bit. The action becomes completely centred around Ben and his emotional breakdown, which to me seems quite a shame. There's so much potential to create a really topical play about what's going on in Syria, and that aspect becomes neglected after this first part of the play, which to me seemed a bit of a waste. The dialogue that Lucinda Burnett wrote was very good, but in terms of themes, it seems like she tried to do too much in the time she was given. That's just my opinion on it, but it's a lot of nice ideas going on, but she doesn't really latch onto one for any length of time, for the whole length of the play. And it just becomes a bit of a muddle by the end. And I came out of it thinking, oh, that felt like almost three separate plays. You have the story about the boys at the beginning. Then you have Ben's experiences in Syria, which was quite short, actually. Then at the end, you have his recovery from his experiences in Syria. But all three sections had very different tone, very different themes, and it didn't connect very well, which I found quite frustrating as an audience member. But the performances were excellent, I thought, from the Company of Five. And there were some really nice lighting choices in the play as well, linking in with the technology and the Xbox Live where the two boys met. But I thought overall the play was a bit of a wasted potential.
John, what did you think about it?
I agree very much with Laura's comments on the structure of the play. I did think it was two or three chunks that didn't fit together as well as perhaps they could have done. And I was particularly disappointed that since Lucinda Burnett had written such really, really entertaining, comic, cleverly observed opening half, if you like, or third of the play, that when you could maybe forgive her for not having too much technical information and having the same degree of authenticity about the scenes set in Syria. But when they returned to Stockport, you would think that she would also have returned to her first act form, if you like. And there's something very disappointing about that. I think I wrote in my review that the play had a kind of dying fall to it. What happens is that when Ben goes to find his chum in Daraa, which is in the south of Syria on the Jordanian border, and is also where the Arab Spring movement in Syria actually began in about March 2011, which is where we are with this. So it's not the conflict that's going on in Syria at the moment. It's not the heavily bombed Syria with the Russian and American military invasions. It is the optimistic political uprising that had just happened in Egypt and then happened again in several other Islamic countries. When he goes there, he has this kind of episode which makes him a little bit autistic. I don't know if that's the right word in the way he speaks. And it means that he can't have proper dialogue with either the girl who's gone with him or with his friend Jibril, who he actually does find over there. And it's very, very incoherent. And I know she's trying to write because she wants to display what happens when you have this kind of mental episode, but it is not easy enough to watch, and you just become annoyed with it rather than sympathetic with the characters or sympathetic to the fulcrum of the play, which is what this is. And as I say, I think after the crispness and humour and authenticity of the earlier scenes, it was an unravelling. And I wonder if something has happened actually between the writing of the play and the producing of the play that has broken its spine a little bit. I didn't find it ultimately as satisfying as we started out. Very, very good performances, of course. Joe Atwell, I think it's pronounced, as 16-year-old Ben. I mean, he's obviously more than 16, but really very, very good in the physical mannerisms, in the sometimes sullen, sometimes charming speech patterns, completely convincing and charismatic central performance. And in fact, he comes over as such a good boy and so charming, you wonder why he's got no friends. Because his only acquaintance at school, he's kind of dispensed with his other chums, is this diminutive and really scabrous playground bully, played with such gloriously chippy abrasiveness by Jill McCausland that you want her to be taken out of this and given her own spin-off sitcom. And I promise you, if you go to Correspondence, you really will call all your best mates biscuit from now on, because it's her favourite word and it just works. I thought that in terms of the structure, there was quite a nod to the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. You know, obviously, if we're looking at plays about teenage boys on the autistic spectrum, then that is where you have to look for your reference. But the way in which he turns boy detective and sets off to solve the mystery of his friend's disappearance is a really good idea. And I was disappointed that both he and sort of the author and director seemed to slacken their grips on reality at that point. I suppose I am unusual among the audience members in that I have been to Syria and know that you can't get from Stockport to Daraa in a day, and certainly not with enough time to search all the internet cafes for your online mate and also go to a demonstration. So again, I think she needs to research a little bit more what happens at the distant end of this geography. But I found that, you know, it might be a picky detail, but I think it's indicative of a narrative that prefers the broad brush approach to the precise. And I felt that also in terms of her observation of Ben's parents. Good performances by Mark Extance and Joanna Kroll. Feuding parents are very typical of marriages that have teenage children. People disagree about how to handle their issues. But making them divorced, making them bicker in the way they did, it felt to me as much of a one-dimensional irrelevance as, you know, the video of Kate and Wills' wedding playing in the background. Clearly, Lucinda Burnett has a point to make, but I think it needs to be a better detailed point about the marital structure and maybe how that's impacted the boy and his mental state. If she has a point to make about that, it isn't thoroughly drawn out in the play. Also, another word of praise for Ali Ariai, who plays Jibril. Very clever, very convincing performance. And I loved the parallels between him and his British friend. So you can see how circumstances have made one teenager grow up so much faster than the other. I also thought the production was really enhanced by the atmospherics in the sound design, which is by Giles Thomas. Very, very graciously done and really effective. And I'm not sure which made me jump more, whether it was the burst of gunfire, which sounded really, really genuine, or the burst of Katy Perry, which didn't. Anyway, I did enjoy it, but I think it perhaps needs one more writing revision. I noticed that among Lucinda Burnett's mentors is John Britton, the guy who wrote Rotterdam, and they obviously write with a similar voice. And I hope that by, you know, referring to playwrights who produce more complete plays like that, that she finds a way to refresh this, because it's very, very good. As Laura said, for the first hour, it's tremendous. And it just needs a revisiting of the second half to make it even better. Paul, what did you think?
Yes, thanks. I think I would also agree, I think, with the comments everyone else has said. I'd also add that the Syrian conflict is incredibly topical as a source of material, so I can see why Lucinda Burnett would want to incorporate it into the work. Like, coming home from the piece earlier this week, there was a story on the BBC, which was in Daraa, about commemorating the 5-year anniversary since these protests took place. And it was basically giving footage of the square and so forth that was depicted in the play. So very topical work. I think the thing for me, I was about 20 minutes into the piece and I flicked through the program and I stumbled across, I think there was a few words from a doctor from the Institute of Psychiatry talking about psychotic symptoms. And it threw me because I was thinking, where is that coming into the piece? Because at that point, we'd looked at the world of the Xbox Live and the young boys that use it, who stay up all night. And we'd started to touch on the Syrian conflict, but we hadn't yet got really to the mental illness, although there were hints about it from comments the parents had made. And I think the piece probably would have had a lot more stronger focus if it spent a little bit more time on maybe two of these three things rather than all of them together. I also didn't believe the scenes where they went to Syria. It just didn't. I think it stretched credibility beyond belief. And actually, given the writer's very interested in actually, you know, this mental illness and the world of gamers, I think it would have been much stronger, I think, as a play if they actually didn't physically go to Syria. And it would have made much more sense, I think, from the mental illness perspective. But having said that, I think the performances of, well, the three young characters in this were terrific and very strong, very focused. Joe Atterwell was quite a revelation as this 16-year-old boy who could move between being somewhat outgoing when he was talking about his work because he was interested in becoming a reporter, and also when he was playing Xbox, but then completely close up when he was around others and completely lose all social skills. I think the other thing, the world of gamers is a rich topic to explore as well, because you've got young boys staying up all night, don't talk much, don't communicate much, but except through their Xbox. And I understand it's, you know, it's common for modern families now that nowadays that you have to turn off the internet before going to bed, otherwise the children will stay up all night. So I think there's a lot of stuff that could be explored here. And, you know, it's not to say it wasn't a great, good play, but I think what frustrates was with the performances and some of the early scenes, you kind of feel like it could have been a lot more. But otherwise, it was quite another good production, though, from the old Red Lion.
I love how we're all suddenly experts on parenting since we haven't got a child between us.
Well, interestingly, I was just told that you need to turn the internet off recently. So I thought, oh, I'll throw that in, because there are quite a lot of scenes where he seems to be lacking sleep. And what was going through my mind is he was probably up all night playing Xbox with his friends around the world.
Well, again, that's structurally inaccurate, because for him to be up past midnight playing Xbox in Stockport, it will be 3 a.m. in Syria, where presumably Jibril won't be playing with him because he's got work in the morning, you know. Evidence of, you know, the older character, or the character having an older lifestyle than his friend in England.
We're now going to talk about The Maids at the Trafalgar Studios. This is a version of Jean Genet's play, translated by Benedict Andrews and Andrew Upton, and directed by Jamie Lloyd and designed by Sutra Gilmore. It stars Uzo Aduba, who people might know as, I think, Crazy Eyes from Orange is the New Black, Zoe Ashton, and Laura Carmichael. I probably need to mention Downton Abbey at this point, but it's actually the first production of this play, which is a fairly famous play, but it's the first West End production for, they're saying, around about 20 years. I think it was done at the Young Vic in 1999. Director was Katie Mitchell, translator was Martin Crimp. We had Angela Clerkin, Anastasia Hill, and Aisling O'Sullivan in that production. I remember that one very fondly. Phil, could you tell me more about this production and what you thought of it?
Well, I've never seen it before, but I know about it because obviously it's such a well-known play. And I know that it was based on this case in France, I think in 1933, where two maids who were sisters rather brutally killed their mistress and daughter, I think it was. But what surprised me about this was the fact that actually it's inspired by that case, but not, it doesn't follow it necessarily. So the end to me was quite a surprise without giving anything away. I found it quite a curate's egg, actually. The design of it by Sutra Gilmore, and this sort of four-poster kind of almost, it's almost a four-poster bed with some of the audience sitting on one side, but the most of the audience sitting sort of in the normal Trafalgar seating, which meant that actually, fortunately, I was sitting the right side of it, because I felt very much that it was very being directed to the majority of the audience, and they were sort of turning around to give some of it to the people at the back, but I wouldn't have wanted to sit there. I kind of blew hot and cold with it. There were some bits where I found the sort of the repetition of the maids enacting these kind of fantasies of killing their mistress quite tiresome, and they do go on a bit. But at other times, I found it absolutely mesmerizing. I think mainly due to the performances, which are good from all three of them. But I thought particularly Zoe Ashton and Uzo Aduba were absolutely fantastic in it. This is kind of some of the best acting you'll see in the West End probably this year. The version by Andrew Upton is pretty sweary if you've got a nervous disposition. I felt overly so. I didn't really need that. But what's quite impressive is the fact that there's this, all these thousands and thousands of petals which sort of drop from the ceiling of the set onto the stage. And they sort of perform really on, which is basically an empty stage, with just these, amongst these petals, which at one point the maids have this very cleverly choreographed sequence where they're delivering their lines, but they're also sweeping the petals off the stage only. And this did make me laugh to have another ton of petals tipped on top of them. All the props are hidden into the little trapdoors in the floor. And this, for me, I thought it was actually a really beautifully done production. It worked in some ways for me. And I think it was the acting that really stood out, that actually kept me going. It's performed without an interval. And the night I went, it was a bit of a late start and it dragged on a little bit too long. So it was a long time sitting there in the sort of rather uncomfortable Trafalgar seating. But we were fairly near the front, which meant that you could really get into it at the times when I really got into it. And then other times sort of drift off in this strange, kind of slightly sort of hypnotic production. I think it's really interesting. I'm certainly glad I went, but I did have moments where I was thinking, please get on with it.
I really wanted to see this play because it's infamous. I don't like just reading the scripts. I wanted to see it on stage. And I was really surprised by how much it went into the psychology of not just master-servant relationships, but the way that working in these subservient roles warps the minds of the people who were in them. So Genet really did some interesting things to, you know, make this underclass come to life. And he also, I'm not sure if it was written that the maids were supposed to be black, because in many, to me, it seemed like the characters might have been white just as well. I mean, there's certainly plenty of white maids in France, but the racial element did seem to come out in the script, and berating people for their color, for not being like, quote, the mistress. And I wouldn't have expected a white male playwright to have, you know, gotten into these kinds of subjects. And I have to believe for the era that it was written, it seemed to be looking at a lot more things than I expected. But ultimately, I felt that the play's ending just seemed foretold at the beginning, and we were just really sitting there waiting for it to, you know, march through to the inevitable. As a murder mystery, well, I mean, it's not really, but as a tension-filled evening, I didn't feel myself at all sitting on the edge of my seat, but I was completely fascinated by the relationship of these two sisters. But it seemed like, you know, Genet wanted to write something that was going to be controversial and make his audience members uncomfortable. And it was just a little too over the top. And I almost think the whole thing could have been told in half the time. I spent a lot of time drifting away with the flower petals myself. And I actually think that it might have been done just fine if the mistress had never shown up on stage at all, because all of the drama really was watching the two women to me. So I would say if you've never seen The Maids, this would be a very informative night that would tick one of those historical boxes off. But I found it like a histrionic production that dragged despite being as short as it was. And I think it's possible that if you've seen this play once, you've probably taken care of your need to see it all the time. But you said you thought the acting was really good, but I thought the material was so clunky that it was hard for the performances to rise above it.
I thought that they did. I thought particularly as it went on. I mean, the slightly hysterical beginning where because you say about that you almost don't need the mistress to turn up. Well, she almost doesn't, because it's about an hour before Laura Carmichael appears, and she's not in it for very long, and it's very much about maid's relation. They play this sort of masochistic sort of cat and mouse game where sort of one is pretending to be mistress and the other one's plotting the murder, and it sort of tos and fros between them. And it's very much about them. And at first, the way that Zoe Ashton was sort of staggering around the stage a bit like RuPaul, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be absolutely awful. But as it went on, I did become slightly hypnotized by their performances. And yes, it is hysterical, but I thought at times that really worked. At times, like you, I was, you know, wanting to, I was looking at my watch, but other times I was completely mesmerized. So it was a real curate's egg. And I thought that the performances in it were really good, and they handled the material really well, which I think there was, as you say, I don't think I really ever have a need to see The Maids again now, having seen it once, but I think this was quite an interesting production.
Yeah, I have to say, when I saw it, my immediate thought was shouty and boring.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it was sort of, the reason you weren't drifting off to sleep is because they kept shouting, and they kept waking you up, almost. I mean, that's a rather unfair thing to say, but it was a lot to do, I think, with the adaptation here. As I said, when I saw it back in 1999, I did not have quite such a problem with the play. Possibly, you know, I'm a big fan of Martin Crimp, so his way of doing adaptations is something I always quite enjoy. And I don't think it was quite as innovative. This is a very innovative way of staging it. I mean, all the petals coming down all the time, and the way they've done it almost all in the round. It wasn't quite done like that at the Young Vic, where, of course, they could have done exactly that in a production like that. And it was sort of a fairly uncontroversial piece of Katie Mitchell, which is rather surprising, albeit 20 years ago. So this one, I mean, I really enjoyed the acting, especially between the two sisters, but I just did not get on at all with this script. It's horrible. Really, I thought it just didn't. As I said, it's shouty and it's a bit boring, and it really shouldn't be like that. It should be, I think, a much better. There is a good play here, even a great play here, but I don't think the script of this, the adaptation, has really got that. I mean, I think all the other elements of the play, you know, the cast, the design, and even to a certain extent the direction, they all come together really well, but I just don't think the script works. But I mean, it has to be said, the original French sisters were, I believe, white. The whole black-white thing has been introduced for this adaptation and possibly for this production. Although I think putting it in New York, which I think is where they've set it, and contemporary, that is a decision by the adapters and possibly by the director.
I did have one of the seats behind the stage. I was sitting in the front row, which I did because it was the cheapest seat in the house. And it was actually rather annoying, even though they did turn to sort of make us feel like we were a little bit more included. But I didn't care for it at all. And I think you would be better off sitting in the back row of the stalls rather than sitting in the front row of the onstage seating.
Yeah, I was very aware of the fact that they were acting to the main part of the audience, and they would do these kind of turns, but I thought, this really proves to me, as if I needed it proving to me, that the sort of theatre in the round doesn't really work, unless it's maybe done completely in the round, and that does occasionally work. Because with this, you really need to see their faces, you really need to catch the nuances between them. And if they've got their backs to you, I don't see how you can enjoy it. And actually, to sit at the back of the Trafalgar Studios would be, for me, absolute hell, because I was glad I was up close on the right side of the stage, as in face, you know, the right side of the auditorium, I mean, able to see it, because in the back it would be too far away. And I think, because it's very, very intense, you'd experience the same thing. I don't know that the racial thing really added a huge amount to it. I thought it added an interesting angle. But of course, if it hadn't had that element, then we wouldn't have had two such brilliant actresses in the role. And I thought they did it amazingly well. At times, I thought they were staggering. Very impressed by them.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page of Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.